Okay, so today I'm back in the salubrious surroundings of the Curzon Street Mayfair Star Sports office with Matthew Trenhow, or Trench to his friends. Matthew, this is the third one, including the Q&A we did, so thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us again. Since we last met, you've left Pinnacle and set up your own business, Anubis, is that the correct pronunciation?
Anubis, yeah.
Trading Limited. And Anubis was a god of funeral rites. Should we read anything into that business name?
Well, first of all, thank you very much, Simon, for having me back. Very flattered that anyone would want to hear me wax lyrical. First of all, must just say, only fair, I put a bit of business Mr. Keith's way on coming to his shop. So there we go, 8th of April, 24. If all the Newcastle favourites place, 50-1. Best thing about this is that after this goes out, someone's either A, going to come back and say, yeah, bet for SP, 3,000-1 this should have been, or, you know, shrewdest bet in the world. I think I know which side I'm on. Anyway, so yeah, so Anubis, Egyptian god of funeral rites. Generally chosen because two things. One, he's a massive judge, because what he has to do is basically weigh your heart after your life's over. And, you know, if it's heavier than the feather of justice, whatever you want to call it, gets thrown to the crocodile god to be eaten. And if it's lighter than the feather, off you go into the land of the dead and enjoy yourself under Osiris. So from my perspective, he's, making a judgment call. And I think so much of trading and risk management decisions is essentially something's happened. You've got to make a judgment call as to what you do next. And whether that is to do with customers, bets you've taken, whatever it is, trading is just a succession of one after another of judgment calls you've got to make based on what information you have. It also did slightly amuse me that Anubis is a massive after-timer, clearly, because you're dead. There's nothing you can do about it. So he's just going to make a call on that. But yeah, that's that and also jackal head, you know, similar-ish muzzle profile to a greyhound. Different ears, obviously, but it just appealed to me. And, you know, for those people who want to read into public schoolboys naming their businesses after mythical gods or whatever, then, there's that angle as well.
So can you tell us anything about why you've decided to go it alone and why you have now?
Decided to go it alone. This is sort of me taking a punt on myself, I suppose. I know some people have speculated as to why I've never tried professional punting before. This is a bit of a punt, really. I'm basically backing the idea that people want to pay me for sort of 20-odd years' experience. This, for me, is big risk by my standards. I just sort of felt like this was sort of the right time. You know, I'm 42 now, and it's a way to sort of slightly uncap my upside, I suppose. As an employee, you're inevitably always going to be slightly narrowed as to like how far you can go to a degree. And the reality is that here, if I'm rubbish at it, it'll be back in the, you know, back begging the bookmakers to get me a job. And if I'm really good at it, it potentially could work out very well for me. I think just a lot of times I've had people say to me, like, can you advise me on X or Y? Being able to be very fortunate to give people good advice that's benefited them. And I thought, yeah, maybe I could do this as a job. Who knows?
So your customers will be predominantly bookmakers?
So I didn't as yet want to restrict myself either side of the counter. I think that there are bookmakers who I can definitely help. There are B2B suppliers, I've experienced in that regard, so people who want to provide particularly odds and trading services to bookmakers. And to be honest, you know, if Star Lizard or a syndicate reached out to me and said, can you help with this, then I'd have no problem with that either. If I work with one, does the other one never want to work with me? I've got to be honest, that's in the back of my mind, obviously. I definitely feel that I know, you know, the bookmaking side of it, you know, pretty decently in the market making side of things. So I probably would expect more likely to get a request from them. You know, if you're a successful syndicate, can I add much to you? Who knows? But I don't rule out either side. But, you know, some bloke punting in his garage. I'm probably not going to be able to step in and give him life coaching or anything like that, I don't think.
Okay, so you're massively respected in the industry and beyond as a judge. So, well, you are. I mean, you know, so at the time of doing this interview, you're a one-man business. So do the bookies need to beware of you, sort of a gamekeeper term, poacher, prowling their markets to sort of enhance your wealth?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm not a big bettor at this point. Never really have been that big. So I would say that the appeal for me has always been the bookmaking side. I'm very interested in playing the hard game in my mind of adverse selection against you. So just in terms of like what gets me excited, I like that. But any betting I do nowadays, you know, would be done via the exchanges, predominantly, I'd imagine. So I don't think they need to worry too much about me. But if they did see me, you know, if they saw my meager fivers and tenners coming through the ticker, then it's a cheap mark. If I am indeed a massive judge, then it's a pretty cheap marker, I'd say. So yeah, I wouldn't be too worried if I was a bookmaker.
Okay, so you've already told us that you're this is your stab at professional punting to start in Anubis anyway.
Yeah, but it's like, yeah.
People do ask, and they are bound to ask, and I'm interested, have you ever considered actually just throwing it all into being a professional punter?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the closest I came was, there was a period where I was out of work for about 6 months, and I was doing a sort of variety of bits and pieces. I was, you know, doing some punting for someone else. I was giving my tissue for golf at the time to other people, doing some just other angles, bits and pieces. And yeah, just for me, brutally stressful. You know, it's one of those things. There's this issue whereby in all walks of life, sometimes you can do everything right and not get the result, but it's just so amplified within professional punting. Your process can be impeccable day after day and you can just get no reward for it. Now, arguably, you can do a job very, very well day after day. No one pats you on the back for that either, maybe, because they just say they expect it of you. But I do think that what is nice, at least for, you know, working for myself as a proxy for this, is that I think that if I work really hard and I really do well by people, that should, you know, give an outsized return, I hope, for me. But yeah, I have definitely considered it. I think probably the missed opportunity for me was probably trying to be some sort of organisational piece for lots of other people who are much smarter than me. I quite like sort of the organisation side of things, you know, quite like a budgeting spreadsheet, that kind of thing. So possibly with the people I know, the sensible thing would have been you focus on doing your tissues, pricing things up, and I'll focus on, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not the one running around a betting shop or whatever, but, you know, I'll focus on finding the right people to help us get on, the right way to do these things. That probably was the admin man for a small syndicate probably would have been the way to go. Is it too late? I don't know, maybe not. But I'm pretty focused on what I'm doing now as the thing I'm going to be doing.
Okay, now this probably wouldn't have affected Pinnacle when you were working with them, but it's sort of a worrying time for the bookmaking industry of all these, the scrutiny on the checking where people's money's coming from, you know, needing to see their bank details and people being reluctant to hand them over. Is that just a worrying time for a small percentage of people to actually win, and horse racing or the bookmaking industry in general?
So personal privacy in general, like this is like a broader topic, really. You know, I right now, you know, if you have a Google account, they're harvesting your information. If you've got an Alexa smart speaker like me, you know it's listening to you. You know, you say something to your missus and then you're getting suggested that product the next day in some adverts or whatever. You know, I've applied for credit cards. People have done infinite, you know, when you first get someone who's like Credit Karma or whatever, credit checking service, and you see the number of soft checks done on you just for like these things, had a car on PCP, mortgage, whatever. you know, people are sort of constantly, you know, Facebook, you know, people are constantly like harvesting your data and getting in your business. And I think if you're someone who's taken a strong stand against this, you know, if you've like got, you know, Proton Mail and, you know, you've done everything to try and conceal the information from other people, then you're sort of in that situation where you've always been against the idea of this sort of invasion of your own personal information. And so therefore, if a bookmaker wants excess, you know, extra information about you, that's just, you know, another thing for you to be against. But the idea that now bookmakers acquiring, wanting to sort of have this level of information about you, I mean, they already got plenty of information just by you logging in, giving your name and address, you know, like they already can build a reasonably decent credit profile almost just from, you know, your postcode tells you, like, one of the key models in, you know, your car insurance, when an insurance company gives you a quote for your car insurance, one of the key, you know, coefficients within that is your postcode. The bookmaker gets that as well. So, you know, there's already, like, a lot of information that they can, that you give them already, that they're going to utilize to determine, you know, how good a customer you're going to be. And when you say how good a customer, you can take that whichever way. So, do I think that this is, sorry, was the question
is it just a problem for the people that win because they don't want people to see who's, I don't know, you know, is it the people that lose probably going to be quite happy just to.
So I think, you know, so there's lots of questions, you know. It's a complex area. So there's right now, if you're on Twitter, there's people who have won, are trying to withdraw money, and they're being caught in this, you know, proof of funds type scenario. So there's things at play. There's sort of, there's the money laundering laws, there's responsible gaming, there's sort of myriad of reasons that these checks happen at bookmakers. One thing you have to remember is that bookmakers have had an absolute golden era of, you know, under regulation, essentially. There aren't actually, if you think about it, many businesses where you put money in and receive money out. There aren't. Most of the times you put money into something, you get an object, you get a service. But, you know, bookmakers are literally something whereby you can deposit money with them and take out more money or less money. But literally all that's happened in terms of the external visibility of the banking organisations is money has gone in, money has gone out. It's semi-incredible, really, that bookmaking has gone this long already without heavy introspective, like, you know, heavy investigative measures, you know, like any financial institution goes through as to, like, the flow of money. You know, you look in Italy right now, if you want to have a licence in Italy, you have to set up your bookmaker so it submits every single bet that's placed into a black box, basically, that the Italian, like, organized crime institute, like, has access to. You know, this was done literally because the mafia was laundering so much money through Italy, through betting shops, etc. So, you know, there's no point sort of getting away from the fact that, you know, the very nature of how bookmakers run and the money flows, it makes entirely a lot of sense to have even more, like, checks than we've had for the last. We've literally had this wonderful period where, you know, I go back 20 years, literally deposit with one bank card, call up, you know, can remove, you know, another bank. So that's probably in part two, I will have to continue on with this, basically.
Okay, Matthew, just carry on with that from part one, please.
So, you know, you've got the anti-money laundering and then the responsible gaming aspect. Which is where, I suppose, more the open banking and is open banking a solution question here, is the other aspect. But the reality is that ever since it became the bookmaker's responsibility to be responsible for people who are suffering with gambling addiction, then you put a price because there's a fine associated with it. So the moment there is a price on it, bookmakers have to evaluate, you know, it suddenly becomes a potential cost in the business, literally in the business plan. So they have to put into place ways to avoid receiving that fine. Let's be honest, all bookmakers want to create as frictionless process as possible. Certainly on the way in, I know people will be saying, like, getting your money in, not having anyone interfere with how you enjoy the product, that is purely in the bookmaker's interest. So the question is, if you're someone who's obsessing over, I deposited £500, I'm withdrawing £2,000 because I've won, and I'm getting all these checks, that is that is, to me, that is just simply obvious that there is going to be extra checks. Now, you're saying, okay, well, why do I have to send bank statements to prove all these things? And it's like, well, you've stepped over the line into this net where you have put money into one institution, you're getting more money out with no visible transferable goods or services other than the service of the entertainment of the bookmaker. And people think, like, well, bookmaking's different. And it's like, well, people hate making exceptions for industries or anything like that. It's not easy. You want to keep things neat and clean. So at this point, how are you going to prove that, this money flow is sensible? Now, you may say, like, well, it's up to the bookmaker to prove, that, or it's up to the bank to prove. It's not to me to send these, banking forms in. Ultimately, these have been implemented poorly. Everyone says, like, well, ideally the check would happen on the way in, and then once you're verified, proof of funds, blah, 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 the money should be able to go back and forward. That's one possibility. You create that much friction to deposit into a bookmaker, many bookmakers are just gonna die, at which point then there'll be more mass consolidation to the only bookmakers who can actually smooth that process. Eventually everyone in the UK can only open a bank account, open a bookmaking account with a bookmaker that has basically smoothed that process as much as possible. To be honest, it's almost impossible for me to articulate all the different, but one thing I noticed, so literally on Nick Luck the other day, saw Neil Channing talking about open banking, etc., and this idea that bookmakers having access to my bank transactions, my banking information. I think people would be surprised how much of their own personal information is available universally everywhere. But the reality is that I firmly believe, get to the point where third-party entities provide basically a checkbox flag, good, bad, medium kind of scenario. And therefore, if the bookmaker only has access to the third party's past information as to whether, yes, no, maybe, and they are well regulated and, the information is well guarded, like if it's Experian, basically, if it's a proxy for your being approved for a credit card, and that's how the open banking is used, the open banking access is given to this third party who's well regulated as opposed to the bookmaker. So the third party's only interest is in protecting their customer, the bookmaker, and you as an entity. Yes, Simon.
I've got a scenario for you. And this is what happens a lot, from what I've been told. When I came in here today, you were putting that 50 quid acker on for the placement. You said you didn't have any cash on you. If I'd said to you, here you go, Matthew, here's a nifty, send it back to me later when you get home. Today, I've also done a silly Yankee. If that silly Yankee comes up and I get a life-changing amount of money, that bookmaker is likely to say, we need to look at your bank account. They see that Matthew Trendhale has put 50 quid in my account. They're quite likely to say, wasn't your bet. We're not having it and we're keeping everything as well. That's what has been happening. This is what people are getting upset about, that the bookmakers are using the information they can glean to basically welsh on you. And there's loads of stories like that. So, what about that aspect of it?
Okay, so at which point, you're going to get into the situation where you've got to prove our relationship, why the money's transferred, etc. And that is protracted. Bookmaking teams have probably not dedicated much staff to resolving these fast. You could be stuck in purgatory for 6 months, a year, who knows. So that's a problem in terms of how much effort is applied by bookmakers to solving genuine scenarios. Will bookmakers ever put huge effort into the the making sure that, you know, there's no welching on legitimate cases. It's not going to be a well-funded department ever in a bookmaker, I would argue.
Do you think that there definitely is, in certain circumstances, the bookmakers are using their powers to not pay if they can?
So I would say that at any given time, bookmakers are under, you know, lots of people who are multi-accounting and lots of people who are potentially doing anything from various, you know, card deposit fraud methods to, you know, you name it. Genuine shrewd people who are just winning because they're shrewd, people trying to abuse things, all sorts of things. So there's a myriad of problems going on. And people getting welched on because they have a pattern that is a corresponding pattern to other behavior that genuinely the bookmaker believes, because of their terms and conditions, they shouldn't have to pay out on, then that's going to happen. Or literally there will be friendly fire hits all the time. And the reality is that, are they incentivized to stop friendly fire hits? Well, no, because it prevents money going out the door. So will these things continue to happen? Yes. You say you've heard lots of stories. It's tired, but bookmakers will always fall back on, well, you know, Bet365 got a million customers. You know, if 0.1% or less of my customers are having these issues, then that already makes me better than 99.9% of customers in other businesses, you know, like who, you know, where they have maybe only 80% customer satisfaction or whatever it may be. You know, so it's kind of like, I think they will routinely sort of fall back on the vast majority of customers have no complaints. But yeah, no, it's at the end of the day, I think, to Hanlon's razor, like, never assume maliciousness when there's, you know, when incompetency is, you know, lack of competency is the explanation. Invariably, someone will be someone will have like a step by step, this has been flagged. Almost never flagged by traders. That's one thing you can almost for 100% assume. These things are never flagged by traders. What's happened is someone goes to withdraw a large amount of money. That amount of money is a net loss to the bookmaker because they deposited X, withdrawing Y. Let's investigate. Goes into investigation, you know, procedural workflow. Go through, does it look like X? Well, it does meet these criteria. Does it do this? What was the method of deposit? Blah, 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 you know. And so you're going to get to this point where some of that filtering process, which has been done for ease, like COVID GCSE result algorithms, you know, whatever solution you come up with that sort of you think's correct algorithmically, will inevitably catch some people who should just be paid, you know. Is that right? Is that wrong? Like, should people invest more into doing that? Should there be a legitimate way for punters to really be able to question that, you know? Is IBAS completely toothless? Is the Gambling Commission toothless with regards to these things? But then, you know, creating a really strong, robust organization to invest, you know, to investigate an incredibly small percentage in real terms of withdrawals from bookmakers. You know, commercially, these things sometimes just don't stack up. So, you know, did someone deliberately say, this person, you know, had a load of bad each ways, and that's why we're not paying them? Nothing from my experience of bookmakers says that that goes on. You know, do, you know, people observe, you know, does, you know, AML officer Y look through all these withdrawals and say, 99.9% of our customers lose money, this person hasn't lost money, that in itself is anomalous. You know, I better put this into the heavy investigation purgatory category, and it will take that person, you know, we will make sure that that person only gets paid if they've proved all 99 points on the checklist. Quite possibly. Is that good? Probably not, but.
Okay, now moving on from that subject, you've worked for a firm that takes on everybody, Pinnacle. Has a restriction route that UK bookmakers have taken, is it just been the easy option for them?
I think that we sort of crossed a line in that once upon a time, it was perceived to be an easier solution. So I went through a period where, you know, the Bet365, you know, was called Bet £3.65. And, you know, and this is going back to the early, you know, 2000s. And what we have is that a bookmaker that became extraordinarily successful, and people look to attribute their success to different things. And it was seen very obviously that one of the things they did was restrict winners very fast, very quickly. So that then becomes part of the blueprint. So people are very quick to try and play catch up, and if that's considered part of the successful blueprint, they're going to copy that over. So that's part of it. This then basically allows, you know, bookmakers to, you know, maintain a high margin by getting rid of people who would reduce the margin. This then, you know, as they look to be making more profits, people who supply services to bookmakers, banks who do processing, all these things, they see bookmakers as an easy way to make money. And, you know, these businesses are invariably cash rich, you know, next to no debt a lot of the time, certainly historically. And so you get into this situation whereby you need to maintain a certain amount of margin. The cost of taking a bet in terms of pennies on the pound goes up. So once upon a time, any customer that lost money essentially was a winner to you. Then you get to the point where a customer needs to be losing at least 1%, then 2%, then 3%. Then you add, you know, streaming services to your website. Then the data rights go up. Then the, you know, like, so eventually you get to the point where just taking a £1 bet from a customer will cost you 3-4p in the pound. And, you know, if you're betting 10 to 11 a side on two-way outcome, you know, that's already a good chunk of it. So then you can get to this point where your single bets almost feel like break even. And so then it's a case of, well, I'm now only making money out of multiples or special, you know, high margin bets. And so I'm going to build more products like that that create high margin. And also I've got to make sure that I don't have too many customers that don't cover the affiliate fees, the banking fees, the new AML fees, the new regulations, all these other fees. So essentially the blueprint that came in, let's be quite clear, bookmakers since the dawn of time have refused business. Even in the old big heavy days, like, you know, go back to the 1800s, art of legging, there would be people who you didn't do business with. You know, in the ring, there would be definitely people who either you turned away, or B, you took the bet and you straight away went to lay it off all the way around the ring. Now, the inability to lay off bets has changed the bookmaker scenario a lot. You know, in the 70s, you could actually move exposure down. You could almost distribute shrewd exposure across the industry. Like, look at like the massive Australian rings of like, you know, the 70s, 80s. Invariably, there was a bookmaker with the deepest pockets who could afford to soak up some of the shrewd money, you know, and there were small people who could, you know, do that. So, you know, the inability to disperse exposure throughout the industry, plus the, you know, the possibly wrongly attributed, the success of Bet365 is went online, had a great product, but everyone else saw the restricting as being a major factor. And then now we've got a point where services to bookmakers have gone up so much that they have to hold so much higher in order to have a really good sustainable business.
Okay, Matthew, now I've asked you permission because I did see on Twitter that you didn't really want to talk about this, but the amount of abuse I get from people, even though I'm not a bookmaker online, because their Arbin and their account gets closed, the amount of hatred, you know, I'm going to use that word, from bookmakers about people that Arb, it's just something that never ends. So I need you, if possible, to put this to bed once and for all. Are bookmakers just crybabies because they're getting caught on the prices by these Arbers? Or are Arbers the sort of people that should be thrown in prison and the key chucked away? I mean, which?
Well, there is a duality there. And I'm going to use some bad language and give you the example. So when I rejoined Twitter, I originally had the username at Massive Arbor. It's one of those things where, you know, in a bookmaking, you know, setting, if you're on a trading floor and someone said, geezers are massive, the unspoken next word is Arbor. It's a bit like saying when someone says, what a bunch of, you know what the next word's going to come. So, you know, And I go back to my very first experience in a bookmaker, and you know, taking bets over the phone. And you had this interesting thing whereby your customer would ring up, take the bet, you know, suddenly would shout over from the traders, "What the fuck are you doing? Geezer's a massive fucking arbor. Like, why have you done?" And you're like, "Oh shit, right, okay, yeah, I've got to, you know, sorry." And so your first thought is, okay, so these massive arbors, right, got to be bloody careful of them. And then you'd be down in the pub later, and you'd hear people talking about it. And often people would talk about other people's, like, a lot of talk about other people's punting, like, you know, so-and-so's shrewd, so-and-so's not. And there'd be someone, like, making a good amount of money in the office, let's say. And then they'd be like, "Geezer's just a massive arbor, isn't he?" You know, completely, like as in, oh, I don't know, he seems to have bought another house with it. Just doesn't sound too bad to me. And it's like, you know, it's a completely, you know, and particularly I understood, well, not necessarily agreeing, understood this idea that essentially, you know, particularly people who used to compile their own odds back in the day, the idea of this kind of purist way of making money. I make my own odds, I compare them to the market's odds, I bet where there's an overlay, you know, this is a true gentleman's battle of contest of wits between, you know, bookmaker and punter. Whereas, you know, arbitrage takes zero effort whatsoever. Essentially, all I need is to have, you know, some way of comparing the odds of A with B. If there's a difference, I bet. And therefore, you know, because no skill is involved, and in particular, no risk. So there's a lot of risk shaming here going on as well. So people are like, you know, if you're not taking any risk, that makes you inferior. And if you don't exhibit any skill, that makes you inferior. From my perspective, that's more the problem of the people making the accusation than the people doing it at the end of the day. For me, I have been incredibly impressed by certain... The thing that always impressed me, actually, has been execution and scale. Ambition, if you like. So when you have someone like, you know, Tony Bloom's created, you know, what was Blue Lizard, then Star Lizard, and he's basically making up his own prices and betting into Asia, you know, and, you know, beating the market with better pricing. What really impresses me is, like, I know people who are doing that with, you know, spreadsheets of an evening, you know, betting into stuff, maybe softer markets than what, well, arguably when Tony started betting, Asia was pretty soft, but, you know, like, spending software markets, and you know, they win like, you know, 5k from their hobby a year, and like, it's nice. I'm, you know, I'm sort of mildly interested, but at the same time, nothing about that sort of makes me sort of astounded. And in the same way, if someone said, like, you know, "Oh, I've got an, you know, Odds Monkey or whatever account, and I make a bit from match betting, $5,000 I'm like, all right, it's just to me, it's almost irrelevant. Like, I'm not more impressed than one than the other, particularly. Especially since when you dig down into it, the vast majority of people who are making money are doing it through at least a little bit of advantage, whether it's, you know, favorable each way terms or whatever it may be. So what really impresses me is when you see people really scale it up. So when Tony's making, you know, hundreds of millions out of basically outpricing the market on football, you think that's pretty impressive. But then when I see people, you know, speaking to people who have done arbitrage on an absolutely industrial scale, you know, people are working against them. People don't want them to do it. And yet they've successfully managed to create, you know, if you told me I made £1 million from betting, and I'm different to most of, you know, the Twitterverse here. If you told me you made £1 million from arbing, I'd be equally impressed by that as if you made £1 million from pricing up your own, like, you know, horse racing tissue. And I guarantee you that 100% of gambling Twitter would say, like, "What on earth are you talking about? Like, you know, obviously it's much harder to price up a horse race. That's far greater money earned than the person earned by arbitrage." And it's like, to be honest, having worked inside bookmakers and, you know, outside, done a fair amount of arbitrage myself, it's not easy making £1 million arbing. You know, I guarantee you that they will have had to have done some, that no one will have given them that money. They will have had to have done some quite clever chicanery to win that amount of money. And I'm interested in those little details. I'm fascinated by the sort of the people who, like, invariably arbitrage people have access to a lot of data because they place thousands of trades. And the way they then leverage that data, instead of modeling horse racing, they're modeling bookmaker behavior, they're modeling market behavior. It's so funny that the next stretch from arbitrage can be market making. And yet, if someone said that I made £1 million market making on Betfair, everyone would be like, oh, bravo. So it's kind of one of those things whereby I completely understand bookmakers' frustration with arbitrage, because one thing is that when something is simple, it often scales. And so basically arbitrage has allowed, you know, every, you know, Mumsnet forum, money saving expert forum, whatever, find a way to make money from slow moving prices, essentially. And in terms of, like, should bookmakers be crying? Well, you know, at the end of the day, it's just a fact of life that you're going to have these people. Do I think the bookmakers could have put... A lot of people say, like, oh, better pricing. To be honest, to make really good pricing, have them observed what the effort it takes to make really good pricing. You know, Pinnacle's best customers are Arbors. They're money generators, net generators. Not everywhere, not every market, not every sport. It's hard to be, you know, brilliant, but they're net positive for them, good customers. But to get to that, the amount of effort and money that has to be put into making, you know, heat and pressure, you know, to make that diamond is extraordinary. And as long as there is another way for bookmakers to circumnavigate this problem, they're going to want to spend that money in ways that gets more people in the door, especially in very competitive markets. It's really expensive to acquire a customer. So, however, do I think that there are certain things that could be done to mitigate the most basic arbitrage? I am surprised that nothing's been done. One thing I found amusing is that there was a guy whose name I can never remember, but he actually set it up in Ladbrokes. This would have been over a decade ago. Set up in Ladbrokes, where basically set up a Betfair Arbot that would basically ping the markets in Ladbrokes for a couple of quid, I think. And it used to have this funny noise, I think the traders told Ladbrokes told me. And every time you heard that noise, you're like, oh, for fuck's sake, like that. And so someone had this idea that traders needed to be constantly notified of when there was arbs against the machine. And at IG Sports, when I worked there, we also set this up whereby we would price into, we would market maker into Betfair. We market made every bloody market in Betfair in £2. Anytime the £2 got snapped up, someone had to go and check the market. So, you know, I do think there are ways that one could mitigate the worst of the arbitrage. And, you know, but again, you're spending money, staff costs, people got to check that. But the reality is and the unspoken about problem is that efficient markets, which is what the exchange arbitrage will drive you towards, don't necessarily, or never actually, make you more money. The more efficient the market becomes, the more likely the customer just loses the expected, you know, randomized, what the margin is. However, if you allow markets to form around what the recreational bettors want to bet, you actually make more than your margin. So if you know that everyone wants to back Tiger Woods for the Masters, you know, topical for this week, you know, you get far more out of it by being able to lay them at, like, you know, 33-1 than the, you know, 200-1 he should be or whatever. You know, that's just the reality is just that efficient pricing in no way gets you the most reward. And people will say, like, oh, but what about the increased volume or whatever? You know, yeah. Well, to be honest, there's a whole other series based on, you know, again, having observed from Pinnacle and from the market maker side on exchanges. Getting volume is not, you know, getting bad volume, piece of cake. Getting good volume, constant struggle.
You talked about Pinnacle, and also Pinnacle would love to lay the arbors, like you say. So how much would the business model of a, you know, just a normal bookmaker active at the moment have to change so that it takes on all comers and still please their investors?
So, I think it's feasible to get to the point where you don't have to worry about, does the person who loses 2% a year cover the costs? I think that getting those people on side I want to think that that's doable. How much money would be required to turn the people who actively win off you into an asset in terms of converting arbitrage money into positive revenue? I genuinely think that it is very hard to do. I'm just trying to think just in terms of, you know, when I think about the amount of money that's spent in relation to turnover and revenue of, you know, the smarter bookmakers. You know, they have skinnier menus, they offer less markets. There's a reason for that. They maybe don't have the best possible websites, they maybe don't have, you know, like, when so much of your money goes on to keeping markets sharpish, then it's hard to sort of have a kind of product that acquires all the other types of customers who couldn't give a crap about, you know, how sharp you are at making prices. So I think that if someone went as far as to make themselves immune to, you know, to monetize arbitrage in the UK, you would end up sacrificing so much of your revenue that you would struggle to get in the good customers in terms of acquiring through good affiliate deals or bonusing or whatever. I think it's very hard. Now, if you create, you know, this is something that was even discussed within, you know, people at, you know, Sharp Books, is like, can you just run, you know, Pinnacle as is, you know, in the UK, like it used to be, you know, sort of once upon a time. Again, you really want people to, like, they still want customers in that they can hold high margin against. So you need to offer a lot of live, for example, and the costs of running live have gone up and up. The amount of data that data people want, etc. Modeling of live costs a lot of money to sort of constantly update it. It's just, I remember speaking to the guys at, you know, I was at Mustard when the bookmaker launched. I remember speaking to the, you know, the people who owned Mustard as a bookmaker, and they had positive trading P&L, so positive hold against the initial Mustard customers were all just incredibly smart UK punters. Positive trading P&L, and once you took out all the costs, it just wasn't an interesting business. It wasn't a business that would get anyone excited who had enough money to start up a business in the first place. You need a degree of, like, someone who wants to do it because of the passion for it. You know, Darren Ravel, who owns, is it Darren? No, it's not Darren Ravel. Derek Stevens, sorry. That is a terrible error. I did not say Darren Ravel owns Circa. Derek Stevens owns Circa, right? You know, he clearly has a real passion for the sportsbook there being, you know, or Joe Brennan Jr., who owns, you know, Prime Sportsbook, whatever. They really are passionate about running a business. And I'm convinced that for the same amount of money they invest in those businesses, they probably could get a higher return, but they want to be doing that business, and all power to them for that.
Okay, Matthew. So life is becoming harder for punters that win. I mean, I don't know how many there actually are, but if you look on Twitter, everyone. Mm-hmm. Whichever way they do it, Arbin, whatever. How would you advise a punter the best way it is for shrewdies to stay under the radar?
So, if we can assume that you will inevitably always appear on the radar when you've won a certain amount of money, that goes without saying. So, you need to make sure that when someone does, you know, you want to try and make your behavior not easily pattern matchable with existing known shrewd behavior. And so when someone does see that X account has won a large amount of money and they look at the bets, you want them to be thinking, that just looks like, you know, on a hot streak, lucky, whatever. So if we break that down a bit more, the most important part of, and I feel I can actually say this because it's hard for sharp people to avoid this, and it's, you know, any bookmaker who doesn't know this already, you know, I don't think anyone will pay me to consult to tell them this, but it's clustering of behavior. It's like people say, like, you know, I got closed after one bet or after three bets or whatever. There are known behavioral patterns that bookmakers know they will not make money long-term of customers that bet in that fashion. And you've bet similar stuff at the same time as other people that they already know are going to be, like, people think that, like, bookmakers don't keep markers open anymore. Well, that's rubbish. They absolutely do. Tend to keep open the person who's the very first to bet them consistently and who bets every single one. But, you know, generally it's just that cluster behavior. So, like, you know, people say, like, oh, I didn't even beat Betfair SP. No, but you bet the same time as one bloke who's had 10,000 bets and does beat Betfair SP, and you bet 5 minutes after him. Because what's happened is that you've probably, he's probably bet, Betfair's moved, you're on Odds Monkey, or, you know, other match betting softwares are available. And then you've basically taken, you know, the those prices. So you just literally just visible instantly. You and 400 other people who try to bet the same thing. It's so, and, like, you know, people who only bet each way on bad each way races, or people who bet, you know, very early soft greyhound prices, whatever. It's like, you've got, you know, one way to sort of make yourself look less sharp is to bet stuff that no one else who's sharp bets, which is very challenging. My recommendation would be that consider what the absolute best possible business for a bookmaker looks like, and then try to find a way to make money from that behavior. So, you know, you've got a brilliant football model. It really is exceptional at calculating fair prices. Well, try only betting the overs and both teams to score yes. And try only betting them in ACCAs. And try and only bet them in ACCAs, you know, 5 minutes to kick. Just go through all the measures, like, literally just go through, like, try and only bet them in ACCAs 5 minutes to kick, and if they appear on the coupon that's on the front page of the website. At this point, you're thinking, like, bloody hell, that seems challenging. You're fucking right, it's challenging. You know, particularly in the UK, tax-free income. I'd like to think we make you work for it, you know. So at the end of the day, I would say, like, you know, whether it's bet builders, make money through bet builders, you know, live, you know, bookmakers hold higher, have higher hold in live than they do in, you know, pre-match. You know, if you're complaining because you're betting, you know, 6 hours before the horse race starts or whatever, I mean, you can complain. I wish you wouldn't do it on my Twitter feed, but, you know, like, you can complain, but you're just complaining about the status quo. Like, don't be man shakes fist at clouds all your life. And if you're thinking to yourself, well, hang on, like, you know, all these, you know, whatever I do, I'm always betting the no, I'm always betting the under, or all the rest of it, or only, like, well, just got to evolve, you know. The idea that there's never been an arb on an over, or never been an arb on a favourite, or never been a, you know, pick your spots and try and win in the most, you know, recreational looking way possible. And the consequence of that is lower margin. You know, bookmakers will look, they've got higher margin holds on over 2.5 goals than they have on under 2.5 goals. So consequently, if they've got a higher hold on that market, it means you're going to have a lower hold on that market as a sharp better. So if you're going to have lower holds, you're going to have more prolonged downswings. And if you're going to have more prolonged downswings, you're going to be living in the torture chamber longer. Torture chamber is just whenever you're in the drawdown. And, you know, the people who are best equipped to be long-term profitable professional gamblers, they're past tolerating the pain. They must love it. I can think of no other reason why you'd be a professional gambler who can go through those long downstrings. You know, like, you know, look at, like, Patrick Veitch's average odds. Or I think they said some average odds was like 16 or even 20s or something like that. Like, you put that through the Monte Carlo sim and see how long your drawdowns are on that. You know, it's real sicko territory to be able to put up with it. So the reality is that, yeah, find something that makes you look like an idiot. Sorry, you know. Actually, that's terrible of me. Very derogatory. Find something that makes you look like you enjoy punting for just the pure fun of, you know, randomness. Make a way to make it win. Realize that, you know, you found a way to win, but it's 2% margin. Scale it up, do it a billion times across a billion bookmakers, and, you know, hope that the only time you get caught is when you're trying to withdraw 50 grand because you landed the front of the page website, both teams to score eightfold.
Right. Excellent. So we talked about open banking in the previous part. Are you prepared to allow bookmakers to have your all your business open banking if you were going to open an account with somebody?
So, bearing in mind all of this is thin end of the wedge, so you want to, you know, make sure that you don't open Pandora's box. Do I already allow through my use of, you know, social media, through the application for credit cards, general experience in the credit system, whatever, does everyone already have access to a very good imprint of my personal wealth? 100%. Do people know what I buy? Absolutely. Go back to the supermarkets, you know, advising women that they might want to get a pregnancy test because of their change in behavioral habits from the nectar points or whatever. You know, so could someone already know everything there is to know about me with the existing data available? Yes. Do I want to make it so simple that I literally can, you know, show, and it's not just a bookmaker, you know, if I went to go buy a car and they said they wanted to see every transaction bank account, I wouldn't want that either. Do I think it's necessary? No. Do I think that we can create institutions which utilize open banking in a highly scrutinized, highly regulated way, and then provide an advice, you know, literally like very anonymized data goes, you know, into the black box, you know, that data then provides a, you know, assessment as to my creditworthiness or my money laundering risk level or whatever. And the bookmakers then get that information for service. You know, I'm going to be, essentially, I still want to, you know, I still want to bet. So yeah, I guess I'm going to, at that point, do I want to be sending, you know, do I want to be uploading documents to a website and the bookmakers, you know, like, you know, if you're a bank, you've had to go to extra levels to make yourself hard to scrape, hard to hack, all the rest of it. Bookmakers probably haven't even put into the, you know, their assessment necessarily yet, the level of effort needed to protect, you know, a website that has people routinely uploading financially sensitive data. So do I want to be doing that yet? No. But it's not because I don't want the bookmaker to know whether I'm a risk from a money laundering perspective or whether I'm a risk from, you know, being a gambling addict. It's more because I don't think that it's necessary for them to know all that information and risk that information. You know, any time, you know, it's like any time you share gossip, it spreads and multiplies. Any time that my banking data gets outside of just the arena that is my bank, you run the risk of it, you know, proliferating everywhere and being sold or hacked or whatever. So, no, absolutely, I wouldn't want that at this point. Do I see, you know, if the same way the financial services world is regulated, to be honest, if the Italian system that I mentioned earlier, if that comes in, you know, if there is some, you know, organized crime authority in the UK which has access to open banking, and one of the services that they provide is bookmaker approval ratings or whatever, am I going to end up letting them see it? To be honest, if it is a sort of, you know, crime-based organized, you know, anti-crime-based organization, probably have access to my bank account anyway. But yeah, no, do I want to be uploading even to a bookmaker who is, you know, FTSE 100 listed or whatever like that? No, but largely because I don't think they'll have the department in place and the security checks in place to make sure that that data is sufficiently warehoused and firewalled from the rest of the business, etc. However, you know, if they did provide a body, you know, an Ofsted equivalent, you know, for checking bookmaker suitability to hold open banking information, if there were bookmakers that then passed that, you know, maybe I would. You know,
would you use a black market bookmaker as an alternative?
So from my perspective, so it's funny, isn't it? Like, so black market is like a loaded phrase.
Well, some guy with a WhatsApp group that will take your bets. They're supposed to simplify it.
That one there. I would pretend, if I had no other options, I suppose, that's for starters, it wouldn't be my first choice. But, you know, if I'm a professional gambler, 100%, without shadow of a doubt. And I would be basically having to do what people used to do when all sorts of comedy bookmakers were in the markets. You know, like, I remember my favourite one is James Moore of BHA investigation fame nowadays, telling me the stories of Banana Bet. You know, the clue was in the name there, right, before someone was running off with your money. But, you know, like, you know, I, basically, once upon a time, everyone would have to do due diligence. Everyone would ask, do you know this person? Do you find out whether they get paid out? Yeah, you did get paid out. All right, really? Yeah, yeah, straight away? Fantastic. So everyone used to basically have the sort of same gossip circle as to who could be trusted, who couldn't be, you know. And then at that point, it's a case of once you do your own due diligence, you'd literally be like, okay, so how much do I deposit to this person? Give it a risk score. You know, you're doing your own credit checking at this point. Give it a risk score and know that, right, okay, when I'm betting, I have to be winning X percent at that bookmaker to cover the fact that there is risk that that money disappears. And people used to do this all the time. Like, people sort of think, like, again, it's like a sort of a luxury to have, you know, instant debit card deposits and withdrawals. And, you know, yeah, even when you got, you know, caught with your hands in the till, they'd just pay you out instantly. Like, that's sort of dreamland now. Once upon a time, people were, like, wiring checks to, like, you know, Jamaica or whatever and all the rest of it, praying to God they got paid. But they knew it was all, you know, it was just sort of almost part of the game. So, like, if someone said to me, like, here's a WhatsApp number, and they told me, like, I trust this guy completely. You know, people who've, like, been in horse racing dealt with commission agents, which often was just the equivalent of a bloke on the phone. You know, the commission agents knew that to get the business, you know, and really succeed, they had to be trustworthy. I mean, I think we're all waiting for Simon not interviews John Loftus, aren't we, really? That's what we're...
We've tried.
Yeah, you've tried, yeah, okay, I can imagine. But it's like, it's so funny, like, even the people who maybe are not very complimentary about Mr. Loftus, one thing's bloody sure is that plenty of people have used him and plenty of people have trusted him to pay them out. And would John Loftus see as much money as he does over the years if he hadn't been trustworthy? You know, I doubt it, you know. There's plenty of people who, like, now run, you know, well, there's no point, I don't want to mention names, but, you know, once upon a time, I think the people at MacBet would have, you know, taken a bet, you know, over a phone call, you know, no questions asked kind of thing. Like, but now they've got the website, they've got everything else like that. Very, very trustworthy. So it's like, it's one of those things where, yeah, you just, it goes into a different framework where you have to price in the risk of losing money on it. You know, that would be my view.
Okay, Matthew, right, so we're on part five, so we're going to have to try and be a bit concise with these because we've got some of these from our good friends on Twitter. Next one, just from me. Are there any murky but legal ways of getting on that you would endorse?
Murky but legal? I mean, it's not murky, though, but it's completely, it's like, you know, at the end of the day, before Bitcoin, people forget... the wonderful, easy-to-use way to do anything was with cash. You know, if you can find a betting shop that you don't take the piss out of, who'll go in, foster good relationships there, get on course, bet with readies, you know, like, that's still, like, you know, like I say, there's nothing murky about using cash. Cash is without affiliate, you know, it's not evil or good, you know, it's just, cash is just cash. So for me, but, like, in terms of, you know, it, Try and find opportunities where you can use cash would be definitely you know, one word of advice.
Okay, now someone, I'm not going to give everybody's names because I haven't written them down, but what do you think Flutter's intentions for Betfair are?
So I think that when presented with Betfair, the original entity, it was making money, profitable company. I think that when they assessed what it would cost pound for pound to get an extra penny worth of, you know, per pound out of Betfair, it came across unfavorably relative to what a pound spent in, you know, Paddy Power would get you return wise. So immediately it would became sort of the ugly stepchild, so to speak, in the relationship in terms of investment. So if you can't find an easy way to spend money to make more money out of a product, the easier thing to do is to cut costs. So they did a lot of cost cutting within Betfair. So we saw the market reduction, obviously, so you need less people to maintain markets, put them up. We saw, you know, the outsourcing, or not the outsourcing, but the movement of the development team or the tech teams out to Romania for Betfair. So they tried to basically squeeze more return out of the same thing. through cost reduction. And they didn't get rid of it though. So they didn't close it, they kept it there. And I think no one wanted to, you've got something that has built up a large presence, you know, it's the dominant force within its niche. And the moment you turn it off, someone else is making the money that you've been making. That's a bit annoying. And also you've got a situation whereby who knows when a part of the world is going to really take to exchanges and you've got an exchange product. So you can't ever turn it off because it may suddenly become really appealing. It may turn out that Africa becomes the next massive place for exchanges for what you know. You just don't know. So in that situation, I think they have got it to the point where they're happy with the cost basis of it. They don't mind that it doesn't make fortunes. They don't mind the business model, but it's there ready and waiting to be deployed. You know, if the US market, you know, they haven't done anything in the US whatsoever. If the US market tends to really love exchanges, they've got something that they can ramp up. So I see it basically persisting and being there, held in reserve in case it's needed.
Okay. Are Entain shares a good punt?
So when Private Jet, stood down, there was a lot of furore over, you know, how awful Entain was and how they'd spent too much on their M&A and they were paid well over the odds. And to be honest, I still think to this day the Kenny Alexander strategy has proven so good that people, you know, Flutter copy it, you know, at the end of the day, or copied it. So the idea of buying into local heroes, say, people who've got a dominant position in the market and there is a barrier to entry, whether it's either through the banking system required in that country or whatever it may be, that's still a sound model. And the fact that people say they overpaid for companies like STS, the Polish bookmaker, I think that was very overblown in terms of, I think, some of the things they bought were still good value even at the toppy end of the price range. So when the share price tanked, the Financial Times did this absolute hatchet job on the CEO, I was like, this seems to be, makes no sense to me that they would price would depreciate this much. Now they've got this trend where a load of hyper-aggressive sort of shareholders that sort of getting in and demanding places on the board, etc. Very wary sometimes of non-bookmaking people getting in and thinking that they know how to optimize a bookmaker. Invariably, there's a lot of cost cutting and they want to make a quick turnaround, make something that looks good in shareholder announcements, this kind of stuff. Don't know. I'm less bullish on it than I was then. But I still think, you know, and they may end up selling off stuff prematurely to sort of, you know, if they sold off, you know, an STS or something like that, having just bought it, you know, they're obviously going to get their throat cut on the price, selling it at a discount. And I genuinely think that that part of the business is something that would go on to prove to be a good buy. So yeah, probably a hold assessment at the moment rather than the buy assessment.
Are there any bookmaking shares at a good punt at the moment?
I mean, I think that I would want to be in there for the FanDuel listing. And it's weird because you have this phenomenon where it's quite often there's a early tank. So the FanDuel shares will be massively overbought initially when they launch, when they list in the US. And then, you know, so they already have this. But, you know, I think FanDuel's probably got a little room to run. And DraftKings probably has a little room to run. But neither of them are attractive enough now that they've shown, you know, themselves to be such the dominant force in the US. Neither of them got enough upside for me to really get excited about them. So you probably want to, like, for always bookmakers, like, will look more garbage than they actually are on share prices. So you probably want to pick something that looks terrible, but in fact has got up. Go on, I'll say William Hill 888. Or it's now been called something else, hasn't it? I can't remember. It's got a rebrand. Anyway, like, yeah. But yeah, William Hill 888 is probably where I'd put my money if I was going to have a punt on a bookmaker now.
Okay, Nick, I will mention Craig Edwards because he's a previous interviewee of mine, ex-professional snooker player, and now he's, I suppose he described as a tipster with snooker and golf. He's interested in mustard bet and their price is still influencing Gulf markets?
So, you know, the best of my knowledge, IMG, who had all the live data rights to golf based on the major tours, not Liv, as far as I know, they came to Mustard to take what was then their B2B golf product, live golf product, and to be basically the sole distributor of it. My understanding is that they are the sole distributor of it. The people at Mustard are still very good at pricing up golf. That's not changed. And from what I understand, IMG have managed to sell the live golf product into a large number of bookmakers. How they utilize that, so which bookmakers will be posting whatever Mustard suggests straight onto their website, and which will just be providing that data feed to their traders to adjust, I've not actually put much effort into looking into. There's some bookmakers you'd suggest that if they took the feed, would just use it as a steer. You know, someone like 365 may be quite independent still with their pricing. You know, Rhodesy at Skybet, you know, if Skybet take it, or Flutter take it, then I expect he still trades live Sunday himself, but, you know, he may take a look at what the prices are being suggested. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see, but, you know, I would say first step is have a look at which bookmakers offer live golf. Find the ones which, you know, find ones that basically have nearly identical prices. And then there's every chance that those people who take all the identical prices are probably just pumping out what Mustard sends them. And the ones that differ probably still have access to it. It's very hard to trade live golf now without the good data. And IMG definitely has all the best speed data-wise. You can tell this just by the number of people who post 365 leaderboard screenshots, which does use the IMG live data on a Sunday or whatever. You know, that's it's definitely the best. So it's hard to put up a competitive live golf product without IMG's data. And I'm pretty sure that when you get the IMG data, you probably with not much extra money, unless it's a rev share, don't know. But yeah, I would say you can definitely look to see the degree of influence it has by just looking at which bookmakers all post similar live golf odds.
I've just realised that one of the questions you said was a banger. It's going to be now, and we've got about 6 minutes left. So the difference in time it took for good gut instinct pen and paper gamblers to be replaced by Excel, and how much time the Excel people have left.
So, I love this question because I love the constant idea that, you know, the increase in advancements in technology like automatically kills off their predecessors. The reality is that they just add scale. So the pen and pencil guy, he can still make money. But it's very hard for him to price up every single, you know, every single race quickly for a day's racing, you know, without any use of even an Excel sheet, if he's doing it all pen and paper. So he has to focus, he wants to be successful, he has to hyper-focus and then bet really big on what he hopes are big edges in a very limited number of outings. The Excel guy, he can maybe price up the whole day's racing in an hour, few copy and paste from different websites, whatever, put it in, and then he's now can be thrown up a lot of value bets. And the Python guy, whatever, well, he can code the getting the data, putting it into a database, database goes into something that prices it, sends it to bots, then bet it at websites, or Betfair API, whatever. So basically you get scale. And the more scale you have, basically, you know, the more bets you can place. The more bets you can place, you can actually reduce the amount you stake to get the same return. You get slightly smooth returns by placing millions of bets over small edges. So essentially, the scaling will actually make you psychologically happier because you'll be able to sort of smooth that all out rather than being the pen and paper guy who only bets big Saturday racing and suddenly has to make all his bank on a few meetings a year. So I'd say that the pen and paper guys get ground out more because it's such a psychological grind to have to bet really big on a small number of things. You know, I think Shane, your previous interview,
Shane,
yeah, he talked about going through some, you know, big long down swings. So someone like him is, you know, he's pricing up as much as he can, but he is going to be capped inherently by the number of hours in the day. Whereas, you know, someone like the Woods Group or Jelco, whatever, one of the big horse racing syndicates, you know, they have all the fair odds for every horse in the race, and then they can just, you know, scale it out. So I think, you know, will these people ever, you know, will one eradicate the previous one? No, but I definitely would advise people to make that transition across those, if only so that they can scale, and with scale becomes actually greater peace of mind.
Okay, second from last question. Why haven't esports caught on in the UK?
Because esports has never been a thing in the UK. I think it's betting. This would be Anthony Kamiskas' question. You look at the places where esports betting has blown up massively. It's Asia, it's the CIS, so that's Russia, Ukraine area, and Latin America. I remember going as a kid, or as a teenager, to Peru, where I've got family, and the internet kiosks that were available in Lima had faster and better internet than they had in the UK at the time. And people were playing online games there, literally. You know, this is 1999, whatever. They were playing, probably would have been like Quake or something like that. You know, they literally were playing like, they had LAN parties, all the rest of it. So we just don't have that cut. We play like FIFA, Street Fighter 2 against each other. This is literally where the SIS product has come from, where you get two guys just playing in Milton Keynes against each other and creating like quick betting. Don't have that, just don't have that culture. Look at Denmark, Australis, massive CSGO team. You know, literally they're betting shops, literally people going in and betting their local Danish esports team, you know, with money, like just cash over the counter. You know, you just don't get that in the UK. So no UK esports product was ever going to really succeed when there wasn't a strong esports culture in the UK. And all these other places also, like the CIS, Asia, whatever, they had much bigger skins betting. You'll have to Google what skins betting is. If you don't know, much bigger skins betting markets already. And so they would transition over to normal betting more readily than anyone in the UK.
Okay, and finally, Matthew, where do you see Anubis in 5 years' time? Where would you like to see it?
So three outcomes. You know, I'm homeless under a bridge. Hopefully not. I have done some work with a client that is so happy with the work I've done. Who knows, maybe they want to bring me on board and just sort of be an employee again. And maybe if we've got on that well, maybe that'll be the right thing for me. Who knows? And what I really hope is that I'll have been able to make a lot of people more profitable, educate a lot of people, or as best I can with, you know, my thoughts and ideas, and maybe even be in a situation to potentially joint invest or advise sort of new business ventures, or get involved with something and be a part owner in something, maybe even. That would be really nice, to be able to sort of put my name behind something eventually. But I think in the meantime, still more to learn, and one of the best ways to learn is to teach others. So hopefully doing the consultancy, I'll meet more exciting people, help them out, they'll help me out, and yeah, hopefully the business will grow.
Excellent. Well, Matthew Trenhill, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Matthew, you've done five parts, but you've kindly agreed to do this little quick bonus thing. People have been asking about the Sport Trade Now Twitter account. Now, I'm assuming that this is probably not going to be a thing for that long, so we don't want to date the main interview by talking about it on there. But as it is a thing now, can you tell us a bit about it? Why we should ignore it or follow it, whichever?
Oh, it's fascinating. So it's the whale tracker account. So whale tracking accounts in crypto and financial Twitter have been like quite common for a while now, and they basically track large trades. You know, this theory that money talks, skin in the game. You want to look where the biggest money is. You know, no different to, you know, if you're in the betting ring, you know, you want to hear when someone's having a massive lump on a horse, kind of thing. So the idea is that they post all trades that go through the Sport Trade Betting Exchange in the US, who I believe are in New Jersey and Colorado currently. All bets over a certain size that get matched, or trades that get matched to a certain size, get posted to that Twitter account. Why is this interesting? Because basically, no matter what anyone tells you on Twitter, a vast majority of people bet very small sizes. You know, not many people bet £500, $500, let alone £1,000, $1,000, or, you know, I think the minimum they have is $3,000. It's not a prerequisite that you know what you're doing to bet bigger. but the probability that you know what you're doing, the bigger you bet, goes up massively. There's a strong correlation between bet size and the likelihood that that person's going to have a clue. That's just a fact. From like, and I can speak for that, not just from, you know, bookmakers I've worked for, but B2B providers I've been for, that's, you know, people who max bet generally have a higher likelihood of being smart. So you've got somewhere that's saying these are what the biggest bets are. So we have to ask ourselves what kind of people are going to bet through the betting exchanges of New Jersey and Colorado. Going to be arbers. Betfair's got a lot of arbers. So we have to ask ourselves, are we interested in, you know, when an ARB happens between the exchange and bookmakers there? Maybe you are, but maybe they're less interesting. But when you ask yourself, at what point does a bet become really fascinating, and what does it have to be on to be even more interesting? So they're posting bets that are in the five figures range. So, you know, when we're over $10,000, now that really is, you know, we can split $10,000 bets down to someone who just wants to have lots of fun, or someone who's really smart, one or the other. And if they're betting on something that seemingly would not be given that kind of size of market anywhere else, you know, so if it's a smaller golf market or a smaller, you know, college sport market or something like that, and they're being allowed to have bets that are far larger than the other operators within the space, at that point, the market makers at Sport Trade are happy to take an opinion, and someone who wants to bet in that size is happy to take an opinion. And one thing that I've learned through bookmaking is that the person who gets to pick and choose gets the better rub of the green than the person who has to just take it. So I would say that any time I see a very big trade on something that is a bit, you know, lower liquidity globally than you'd expect, I'd want to know what's going on there. I want to know what the thought process is. They've done a little bit of tracking. They posted, like, there's not a huge amount of bets on it yet, maybe a thousand or so or something like that, but they posted a bit of analysis on it, and they showed that they were small up on some sports, these whale tracker bets. If we treated the whale tracker as one customer, they were small up on some stuff. I think they were down on baseball, but up quite a lot on golf, for example. But it'd be interesting to see how it plays out. But, you know, at the end of the day, so one of the large crypto bookmakers actually had a reel of the biggest bets that went through the website on their site. And there was someone who actually scraped that bookmaker's website just to see what the biggest bets going through. Again, the same principle that anyone who bets large size in crypto could be an idiot, could be an absolute genius. It's sort of interesting to see. And again, seeing what they're betting on, when they're betting on it, probably give you a good clue. You know, it'd be nice, you know, now Betfair does so much of its turnover based on tiny, tiny matching exchanges, like tenors traded thousands of times over. So you wouldn't see the big lumps it used to, but God, you know, Betfair circa 2006-07 or whatever, if someone told me whenever 10K got lumped on the exchange and matched, I'd be very interested to know what that was on at the time as well. So yeah, that's the basic principle.